from PRX.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
And I'm sitting on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial.
This first level of garden.
This is Thomas Jefferson's vegetable garden.
I'd like to have the roasted chicken, please. Very well done.
Editing is all about timing.
I try to get a little bit away from the actual subject.
You must get sick of your own voice, right?
Studio 360.
With Kurt Anderson.
I think we should get naked.
What?
That was Owen Wilson in the Ben Stiller movie Zoolander at the beginning of its orgy scene. It's a very funny sex scene, which makes it so unlike so many Hollywood sex scenes, which are comically bad. Because of Valentine's Day, we're taking a look at how movies and TV are evolving when it comes to depicting sex and sexuality, which means some segments on this episode might not be right for all listeners. When I was a kid in the 1960s, 12 or 13, and occasionally got my hands on copies of Playboy, one of my favorite things was a recurring series, The History of Sex in Cinema. It was by a couple of serious film critics. You know, history, cinema, plus sex, years before my first time doing anything serious. To start today's show, we're talking about the cinematic history of first times. As in life, movie depictions of losing one's virginity are often unintentionally awkward.
We all bring so much baggage to our own conception of the way that we have sex and understand sex. It's just tricky to get any kind of nuance right into, like, get across interiority and to completely show the mechanics of it in a way that doesn't cross a line into pornographic.
That's Jeffrey Bloomer. He's a culture editor at Slate. We asked to run us through film depictions of deflowering, how they began in American movies only after Hollywood's total self-censorship regimen ended, the so-called Hays Code in 1968.
Previous to that, you had to basically show consequences, and you couldn't, of course, show any actual sex. So when you think of movies like Rebel Without a Cause, which is sort of like the foundational teen angst movie, you don't really see much actual sex in that movie, but the possibility of these kids being sort of torn up about it and wanting it was enough to lead to calamity.
He called me a dirty tramp. My own father.
Sort of directly after that, a lot of scholars who have written about this have sort of noted it as like a post-virginity era where there wasn't a lot of exploration of the actual first times because it was just got right to the everybody having tons of sex. It was sexual revolution, liberation era. So you have movies like Last Picture Show that has that kind of 1971, I think, and it does take on those themes pretty directly, but it does it in sort of a hyper-shocking, sexualized way. There's sort of that infamous pool scene, if you remember, where she has to disrobe in front of the pool, and then...
The she being Sybil Shepherd.
Yes, excuse me. And there's a later one with Jeff, a scene with Sybil and Jeff Bridges, where it's more explicitly about her wanting him to take her virginity, and he can't.
What's the matter? Aren't you going to do it?
I don't know what's wrong.
What do you mean? How could anything be wrong? Just go on and do it.
Part of what it's doing is deconstructing the classical era's depiction of sexuality while also depicting it itself.
The floodgates had been open. Just a dozen years later, in the 1980s, losing your virginity movies had become a genre.
There was a scholar who called it the Sex Quest movie.
Dave's been itching for it. Woody can't stand it.
If I can wait, why can't you wait?
And Spider will do anything for it. There comes a time when nothing seems more important than losing it.
It was like Losing It and Porky's and all just all about these boys and sometimes girls, but mostly boys, just desperately searching away for ways to lose their virginity. It just became more about like an adventure comedy type thing that was broadly universalizing the experience through comedy and making it into kind of a farce. And I think one movie in that era that often gets lumped in with these kind of dumber, broader movies is Fast Times at Ridgemont High from 1982.
Do you think guys find that more attractive?
Oh, Stacy, please, give me a break. You are so much prettier than them.
Jennifer Jason Leigh's character is probably the closest thing the movie has to a protagonist, although there's lots of parallel storylines. And I think what she goes through in that movie is sort of a beginning of a more complicated era in the way that we understand sort of how people lose their virginity and what happens. She loses it very quickly to an older man after lying to her age, and by older I mean like mid-20s.
Am I gonna get to first base? Are you really 19?
Yeah, I am. I'm really 19.
This is Fast Times at Ridgemont High, the Jennifer Jason Leigh character losing her virginity to some older guy in a concrete baseball dugout with graffiti and terrible lighting, and it's pretty grim.
Yes, it's not great, but she doesn't leave the experience traumatized. She's more just like confused and feels like she wants to take ownership of her sexuality. And so she quickly has sex again with a boy at school who's kind of a jerk and doesn't really stick around, and she ends up pregnant, and people who remember the movie remember that she has an abortion. But I think that what's nuanced about this movie is that there are consequences, but she's not ruined by them. It doesn't destroy her desire to have sex. And I think at the end of the movie, she's like sexually, she hasn't quite started sleeping with her new boyfriend, but she seems very happy. And she's like emerged from this period of discovery intact.
So there were many, many more attempts in the 80s, from The Last American Virgin to Hard Bodies to Screwballs. And by the end of the decade, right, the explicit teen sex romp comedy had pretty much worn itself out.
So in the 90s, it kind of, the teen sex movie and losing your virginity kind of wasn't necessarily an enormous genre for a while. And in the 90s, you sort of get a resurgence of raunch movies that are more ironic and more winking and more inclusive of female pleasure. I mean,
American Pie? No, what?
Well, that's sort of what I'm talking about. That came late in the 90s, I think. But that is, I mean, yeah, women in that movie had desires too, as broadly sort of depicted as they were. And I think also there's like teen dramas that were like the movies that were really popular when I was a teenager, like Cruel Intentions.
I'm impressed.
Well, I'm in love.
Pull me out from inside.
And there's a Loss of Virginity scene starring Reese Witherspoon and Ryan Phillippe that's set to Counting Crows' Colorblind. And it is sort
of... It sounds like a parody of a 90s movie.
It's sort of... I won't go into it too much. It's not necessarily a great depiction that's worth breaking down too much, but it is an iconic moment. And I think so you see a lot of that. The kids know more about what losing virginity will look like.
By the turn of this century, Jeffrey says there was a shift to more earnest, realistic portrayals, like in the movie Love and Basketball, which a generation into the AIDS crisis also features a depiction of safe first-time sex.
Yes. So Love and Basketball is a movie from 2000 that really comes at the sort of tail end of these new depictions that are more even-handed and more emotionally and perhaps physically realistic. It's about two basketball stars who, from high school to college, really from childhood, are sort of connected. And in the scene where they lose their virginities, the camera just sort of sits next to them on the bed, doesn't really move. There's like light music playing, and they both look terrified. And you know, you see him grab a condom, you see him put him on off screen, of course, and then they just slowly go into it, and they don't necessarily look like they're in ecstasy. You know, it's like it really looks like the way that you would, that most of us probably experienced it.
I think, for instance, fairly recently, we had on this show Mariel Heller when she had the film Diary of a Teenage Girl on, mm-hmm. which was kind of remarkable in what it did.
What it does is it shows, I think, how morally ambiguous you can become in depictions of losing it. So basically, it's about a 15-year-old girl who falls for her mom's boyfriend. And I think it's in the late 60s, early 70s.
I had sex today. Holy shit.
So in the movie, though, I guess you would say that the boyfriend, I think, is in his 20s. You would peg him as...
Or older, maybe.
Yeah, he might even be in his 30s.
Yeah.
You would peg him as a predator. She's 15.
Yeah.
You would, but the movie doesn't really depict it that way.
I think... This makes me officially an adult, right?
Obviously, there's moral ambiguity there, and you can debate the way that what you should take away from that.
Right.
But I think the way the movie depicts it is very much through her lens. It doesn't sexualize her or her body, even though that's very present in the movie. It's more about her discovery and like what she learns as she goes along.
I get distracted sometimes, overwhelmed by my all-consuming thoughts about sex and men. I always want to be touched.
I think what Mariel Heller did with that movie was very brave and very in keeping with what an actual girl that aged in a situation like that, how she would behave, how she would think, how she would act. And I think that that is kind of what we're starting to see more of now in depictions of adolescence.
And another great film, 2017, Call Me By Your Name, another adult and kid thing.
Yes, it's true. The boy in the movie is 17, and he falls for a 24-year-old. In the actual movie, they're played by Timothée Chalamet and Armie Hammer, so they look even further apart in age. But I think, again, what you see in that movie is sort of a very strong lens from an adolescent perspective, discovering things. And what I really like about that movie in particular is that it really has like a pretty positive gloss on the sexual discovery, but also shows the emotional fallout, which comes in a few scenes that are pretty intense and serious, but they don't destroy anyone.
I don't want you to go.
It's about sort of the more ambiguity of the situations that kids these age find themselves in and lose their virginities in, and also how they navigate them.
When we started talking about having this conversation, I didn't come to it thinking, oh, Hollywood has actually gotten better at this, but it made me think like maybe they have.
I mean, I think that the audiences have just become too sophisticated for the completely moralistic black and white depictions that we used to sort of have, or perhaps the extremely broad 80s comedies as you know, losing your virginity and being open about it as a teenager has
right.
become more mainstream. I think that perhaps that's what we saw. But I think there's still a lot of really bad stuff out
yeah.
there. Like, to be clear, we're focusing on the good stuff.
You can find Jeffrey Bloomer's articles about movies and other cultural stuff at Slate.com. So that's how movies portray the awkwardness of sexual initiation. Coming up, we'll talk about the real-life awkwardness of actors pretending to make love.
If you are doing something where, say, you have to be in a situation where you have to be very close or we can't have anything hanging, oftentimes I'll ask them to wear a dance belt.
The observations and insights of a Hollywood intimacy director. That's next on Studio 360, right after this commercial break. Today, we're examining the portrayal of sex in movies and on TV, a subject, I'll mention again, that might not be right for all listeners. So, in real life, nearly all adults have had sex, plenty of times. Therefore, if you're directing or acting in a love scene in a movie or play, who needs specialized expert advice? But there, so to speak, is the rub. We're all pretty much equally expert.
I think people in theater and in filmmaking don't give the audience enough credit because we are going to be able to call bullshit on an inauthentic love or sex scene a lot easier than an inauthentic street fight.
Meet Alicia Rodas.
Most of us have probably kissed someone before or been in an intimate setting before, so it's easier for us to call bullshit on that.
Alicia works for Intimacy Directors International, and her job is to help actors do love scenes as well as they can and as comfortably. After all, the Me Too movement got started in 2017 after it was revealed that the movie mogul, Harvey Weinstein, had exploited and assaulted actors, apparently dozens of women. Thus, intimacy directors like Alicia Rodas are increasingly being dispatched to movie and TV sets so that actresses doing sex scenes don't feel coerced. But she's also there to make sure that male performers feel comfortable as well.
There's always the conversation with wardrobe as far as modesty garment. You know, if it's a sock, there is often a dance belt. It's a piece of clothing that male dancers or person who has a penis uses. And it basically is a thong that then comes up and they pull everything up and forward. If you are doing something where, say, you have to be in a situation where you have to be very close or we can't have anything hanging, oftentimes I'll ask them to wear a dance belt.
Alicia started out as an actor, but she had dance and martial arts training, so she became a fight choreographer. Then, more and more, directors were asking her to stay and help choreograph the sex scenes as well. We're going to listen in on a recent workshop of hers where Alicia is running scenes with the actors Michael Magliocca and Mary Hickox.
We take care to make sure our actors are taken care of, not just on the physical side, but also on the emotional side. All of us that work with IDI are certified in mental health first aid. There's a lot of conversation with wardrobe that happens. There's a lot of conversation with the DP as far as what they want set up. Every set is different. There are some directors I work with that they say, I want this, this, and this. Please get it for me. But there are also some directors who just don't want to have anything to do with it. They want the story told, but they're uncomfortable doing it themselves. That's okay. I mean, plenty of directors aren't comfortable doing a car crash. You hire a specialist. So that's what we're providing. It is, one, an acting technique. It's a technique to get the actors connected to each other. Two, a set of protocols and procedures so that everyone who is there knows what's going on. And three, it is an advocacy. You have value and you don't have to be put in an unsafe situation.
When I clap my hands, I want you to both look in each other's eyes and you're just taking in the energy and giving energy back. And three, two, one.
So this exercise is called instant chemistry. We are in a society where no one makes eye contact anymore. So it forces everyone to look at their partner and take in their energy and just give energy back.
Now I want you to imagine your partner when they were 4 years old.
It is a way to explore empathy with someone.
Now I want you to imagine your partner the last time they had their heart broken.
It's letting them know that just standing and giving someone that romantic intention is so fascinating to watch.
Now I want you to imagine you and your partner happy together.
There's got to be an understanding of the story between the director and the intimacy director and the actors. This is the climactic scene often. They kiss, they fight, they fuck. It's a discussion of the story, and knowing that everyone's on the same page of the story.
Yeah. So let's think of a context that puts us physically on the floor. You are at the party, people on the floor hanging out. Maybe it's a loungy. Yeah.
Thought I'd start with a classic. So this scene is Romeo and Juliet, the palm to palm scene, where it's the first time that they see each other.
Let lips do what hands do. They pray.
Saints do not move, though grant for prayer's sake.
Then move not, while my prayer's effect I take.
Great. So are you guys all comfortable, pretty confident as far as how you're getting there?
Yeah.
It was this cool moment where he sat down next to her. He had taken her hand and was holding it, and I believe going to kiss it. And she withdrew it in that exact moment and then replaced her hand to his hand. So she was saying no, retracted her hand back, and she instead put that barrier of no, it's palm to palm, where it is all obviously consensual in the way their bodies are, the way they are leaning into everything. It is obviously consensual. There is just a little bit of play and retraction and pushing and pulling that happens between them.
So as we go in for the kiss, which way did your head naturally turn?
I think the first time it was this way, the second time it was this way.
Okay.
So let's begin to lead to this way.
Okay. Great. So let's go, since we'll say like camera stage is down here, we'll say that you're tilting your head up, so we've got a better view of you.
So they are already aware of how to work consensually with the other actor.
Talk about where it's good as far as where is good for the touching for that first kiss.
For me, my whole leg is comfortable if you want to explore that. Okay. Arms as well. Okay. Where can I go on your neck?
Here. Neck is good. Don't go inside my ear.
Just
you want to lie down, neck, this is
great.
All
placing your hands
okay.
Here.
Okay.
As well. If my hands were to explore up to your arm, is it okay if it passes your hip on the way?
Yes.
There was no hesitation. There was, may I do this? Yes. May I do this? Yes. May I do this? That's fine. You know, a director can say, grab her by the shoulder there and pull her towards you. It's like, okay, so you just got permission, but you didn't get consent. Because I can give you permission, but the other actor has to be the one to say, yes, that's okay.
Would you mind exploring some way to go from there into even taking her hand and maybe bringing it close to your chest? Because your hips are facing away, how to get them facing towards each other, even if it's yours or getting inspiring her to do it first.
my big MO with direction like this is finding what language is going to speak to that actor and what movements are going to come out of them the most naturally. There are specific movements, the way that we do smoke and mirrors in stunts or in fights. There are smoke and mirrors that we do with the intimacy work as well. Often it's hips, it's being right on versus off just a little bit. It's cheating angles.
Pacing up.
All trespass sweetly urged. Give me my sin again.
You kiss by the book.
Lovely, lovely. Nice, nice. All right, how'd that go for you all?
Good. I forgot my lines.
Sure, sure.
So there's choreography. We just don't do things that aren't choreographed. Improv can exist, but it has to be specifically set as to where and what that improv is, what your boundaries are. Because nothing is going to take you out of something faster than suddenly having your boundary being crossed without your consent or your boundary being exploited. It's like, I want to make sure that every time I'm doing that kiss, that it doesn't suddenly last longer than it should, or it suddenly goes further, or hands start wandering. And then I, as the actor, would go, okay, what did I do to make that person do that to me? Or what am I doing? Why am I pulling closer? I think I'm starting to have feelings. And just the tumbleweed and the snowball just rolls. So it's repeatable to the nth degree.
So let's just get some specifics out. It's like office Christmas party.
I like that a lot.
Great, great. You guys have been working together for how long?
3 years.
Putting out the note of, because your body is in a certain position and you're going to be doing this thing over and over again, that is going to tell your body a different story. It's going to tell your mind something else. You know, I use this in my workshops where I say, you know, if I shrug my shoulders in and I tighten myself up and I like breathe fast, I'm going to start to feel scared because my body remembers what that feels like. And if I, you know, open my neck and I rotate my hips a certain way, I am going to possibly feel aroused. And that's okay. That's my body remembering what that feels like.
First inhale, hands coming up, hands coming down. Second inhale, exhale, hands coming around and find the post, push back.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry.
This is the worst.
I know.
Turns away, quick grab of the hand, slow pull back. And he slowly bridges distance, but then she bridges distance with her face towards him. 1-1000, 2-1000, 3-1000, furrow and pull back.
The emotions you are feeling are authentic, but it's doing that because of the actions we are doing.
It's not to discount this. It's not to discount the moments that you have, because it is. It is something. It's beautiful. We witnessed it. It's,
right. Yeah,
it's intense and lovely.
Yeah, about being encouraged to follow that, you know, biological impulse, chemical mm-hmm. impulse, mm-hmm. instead of it being like, ooh, it was there and it shouldn't have been there. Like, no, it should be there. Embrace it so that you can breathe.
Yeah, and, yeah.
You know,
and
it's not
away.
This secret thing.
Walking away from it is a little hard because I just put so much into it. You have all the physical issues that someone can have when performing scenes like this. And then you add in all of the mental and emotional trauma that can be caused by scenes like this. And we have a rich, rich history in entertainment of taking advantage of our actors. I always give my actors some sort of closure to the scene after we're done filming or we're done rehearsing, where we tap and say, okay, what happened here? Happened here.
Nice. Really nice, guys. Yeah. Turn towards each other. Give a nice tap out. Beautiful story. Beautiful moment.
And then we finish. We tap out.
Awesome. Get three here. Lovely.
Thanks.
So it's taking that moment to say, what we did was authentic, and now we go away.
That was Alicia Rodas. She's worked as the intimacy coordinator on shows such as Deuce and Crashing, among others. At studio360.org, you can find links to some of her work.
Are you straight for John Chris?
No, seeing a guy doesn't make me straight.
That's Desiree Akhavan and Brian Gleason on the TV series The Bisexual, a show Akhavan created, co-writes, and stars in. It premiered last year on Hulu.
So I thought Sex of the Man would be a complete departure from Sex as I Knew It, but it's actually very similar. Sex is sex. There are differences, though. Like, his BO. He's got good BO. It reminds me of my dad's, only it's sexy. I'm sorry, am I making you uncomfortable?
In the series, Akhavan plays Layla, who, like Akhavan, is Iranian-American and in her 30s, and bisexual. The character has been in a relationship with Sadie for 10 years. Sadie's a lot older than Akhavan's character, and the two run a business together in London. The series begins at the end of their romantic relationship, when Layla decides to explore her attraction to men. Layla is uncomfortable with the word bisexual, even though she feels it describes her accurately. Same with her creator, Akhavan.
My feelings about bisexuality have been really negative, but like shame-based, you know? I feel like whenever I see it reflected at me from the outside world, it seems incredibly tacky and in bad taste, and also, yeah, duplicitous, someone who has no loyalty, someone you can't trust.
Yeah, there's no such thing as bisexual. That's just something they invented in the 90s to sell hair products. Deal breaker.
People are so prejudiced against bisexuals, though. It's like the only group of people you can still make fun of. It's like bisexuals and Germans. And I happen to be both.
Oh, so you're like bi?
I think that's in film and television, but it's also in people's expectations. And I think that's purely because not many people have come out as bisexual. It's one of those lifestyles that you're rounded up or down depending on who you're in a relationship with at that time. And you just end up kind of identifying with whatever is the most convenient. And it's hard to be, it's something you have to actually out yourself as. I think it's actually like very embarrassing that I'm such an obvious bisexual that I've made it such a point of conversation. I definitely had to defend making this series because it was so taboo. You know, it was lesbians who in my life who said that that's inherently offensive, and the narrative of a woman leaving a woman and dating men is just wrong. I want to know, why is it wrong? We're not saying one is better than the other. It's just the truth of this woman's sexuality, that she's been denying it and wants to explore that. Why is it inherently negative to see that narrative? So I definitely felt like I had to defend the premise of the series and the premise of a woman who wasn't entirely gay. That's what a lot of lesbian-centric media does, which is, you know, put its claws out to anyone who would deviate from just being exclusively with women. And that's the hard thing about bisexuality in general, is that there's this sense of disloyalty. The L Word is a show by lesbians for lesbians. This was a clip from The L Word where Alice and Tina are talking about Tina dating a dude for the first time after Bette.
How do you not know this? Where have you been? Oh, right. Stuck in the far reaches of Heteroville. That's right.
Yes, it's so scary.
Ooh, scary.
I think I remember you lurking around there a couple years ago.
But I did come into my senses. See, that's the difference between you and me.
There's a lot of harshness here, but it also is saying, don't worry, viewer, we're on your side. So I'm looking at this as a filmmaker, like, yeah, as a bisexual, like, that's lame. Like, Alice starts the show such a fervent defender of her bisexuality, and then she's saying, you know, I was bi, but now I've come to my senses. But I think that's the nature of the series, wanting to feel like it's inclusive of lesbians and doesn't want to alienate the world that it's creating, which is again, for that time, fair enough, but also super fucked up. Like, I think it's really hard to stand by a bisexual narrative. I mean, I think it all comes back to that Sex in the City line, which is what Miranda said, that it was greedy.
You know, I think it's great. He's open to all sexual experiences. He's evolved.
It's hot.
It's not hot. It's greedy. He's double dipping.
And it is greedy, but also who cares? The gals are, you know, brunching and discussing Carrie dating a man who says, I'm bisexual. Is that okay? And she feels like it is genuinely not okay.
When did this happen? When did the sexes get all confused?
Somewhere between Gen X and Gen Y, they blended and made XY.
You know, I did the date the bisexual guy thing in college, but in the end, they all ended up with men.
So did the bisexual women.
Which explains why there are no available men left for us.
I feel like this scene is just a reflection of the time in which it was shot, which was almost 20 years ago. It's tricky because it's so much about their fear that it's not a thing, that a man who would be attracted to another man would definitely be homosexual and incapable of loyalty to a woman. It pre-assumes that bisexuality isn't possible, which I think two straight single ladies in 2000, it wasn't. That's the thing about Sex and the City. I watch it with love. It's still fun. Like, it, in some ways, it hasn't aged well, but I really love it, even though the scene sucks and is super, super obnoxious. All right, so this is Orange is the New Black. All their crossings, taking steps is easy,
standing still is hard. So I never carried drugs, just money.
You were a lesbian?
At the time.
You still a lesbian?
No, I'm not still a lesbian.
You sure?
I mean, what's interesting is bisexual isn't an option for most people. Like, I think they don't even consider it, that it was like, I was a lesbian and now I'm not anymore. I think that's what reiterates a lot of the discomfort that gay people have with bisexuals. This idea that you could have been and now you get to drop that off and go back to the straight world. And then later in that season, she ends up going back with her ex-girlfriend. So she is a bisexual character. No, they didn't use the word bisexual, but she is. And that character can't face it. So I think, like, I want to view all these in the context in which they were written, instead of being offended that, like, out of context, yeah, it seems super biphobic and obnoxious that she's not saying that she's bisexual. Look into real life. Like, I know bisexual women who will not call themselves that. This is a clip from my series, The Bisexual.
It wasn't just sex.
And it's when Sadie has seen Layla with a man and they're confronting it for the first time.
You know, it's funny. I blame myself, you know, for not being able to satisfy you. How long have you fancied men? Why didn't you tell me?
Because it didn't matter. I was in love with you. It wasn't relevant.
It's relevant.
You couldn't satisfy me because you stopped trying. You're so fucking rigid. Like, you like what you like, how you like it, when you like it, and that's it.
You know why I'm like that. You have to be a robot to be successful in this industry. You know, my mother, have you any idea what it takes to be a dyke growing up in Burnley in the 80s?
Tell me.
No. I fucking won't, because you are not my girlfriend anymore. Thank fuck.
You know, it's painful on a lot of levels. I don't think it's just Sadie being upset about her hooking up with a man alone. I think it's also about the fact that there's so much of her partner of 10 years that she doesn't know, and that you can be with someone for that long and hold such a huge part of yourself back. Yeah, and we also discussed, you know, generationally why it's different for Sadie having grown up in the 80s and being in a relationship with someone of a different generation. The same way that Layla bristles against a millennial in her 20s who identifies as queer but hasn't, you know, been in a romantic relationship with a woman. It feels trendy and of the moment. I mean, I think you're saying you're part of a club when you're queer or pansexual. People really are relishing, you know, the vagueness of queer, which, you know, I appreciate it. I use that word as well, but I think the specificity of bisexual is important because the more you use a word, the more you can destigmatize it. Like, it has to do with my ethnicity. It has to do with a lot of things about me that are different. It's a lot like race. Like, I think our differences matter. I think they should be not just celebrated, but, you know, out there. To say that we're not different, that we're all under the same umbrella, is not true. And I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's a positive. We are different races. We are different cultures. And that's something that I want to acknowledge and celebrate in my work.
Desiree Akhavan created and stars in The Bisexual on Hulu. Hannah Harris Green produced our story. Coming up, we move from sex to Gen X and the movie that probably did more than any other to define that generation.
There's no way to formulate, okay, we're going to make a generational movie about these crazy kids today. I think you can just make an honest movie.
Reality Bites, 25 years later. Next on Studio 360.
Studio 360.
That's the Procol Harum song, Whiter Shade of Pale. Came out in 1967, but then a generation later got revived and more permanently embedded in pop cultural consciousness on the soundtrack of The Big Chill. Baby boomers had The Big Chill. Gen X has Reality Bites, which came out in 1994, starring Winona Ryder as a recent college graduate. She's in a love triangle that embodies her own confusion about what kind of grown-up she wants to be. More like the boyfriend Ethan Hawke, the melancholic rebel poet dude, or like Ben Stiller, the charming-ish corporate yuppie. Reality Bites was also directed by Stiller, who thereby becomes this Studio 360 episode's recurring character. The movie was released in theaters 25 years ago this week. And our story about it begins with the screenwriter, who was in her early 20s at the time.
My name is Helen Childress, and I wrote the screenplay for Reality Bites. I was a student at USC in the screenwriting program. I won a writing contest for a screenplay that brought me to the attention of a producer. And since I was literally 20 years old that year, that was 1990, I was hired to write something. We didn't really know what. At the time, there was no Generation X. It was called the Baby Busters. And so for a long time, this was called the Untitled Baby Buster Project. I think we were all struggling to figure out who we were and what we wanted to say in our lives as artists. In a way, the film is a documentary about that, told in a fictional way.
I'm making this documentary about my friends, but it's really about people who are trying to find their own identity without having any real role models or heroes or anything. But
wow, sounds great. I mean, it seems like your friends would be perfect for that.
Ben Stiller directed short films and his show, The Ben Stiller Show on Fox, but this was Ben's first feature film. Ben had me in every rehearsal and on the set. It wasn't like I was there to protect the script or anyone was changing anything. It felt highly collaborative compared to what I think most movie sets feel like for writers.
I lost my job.
But you shouldn't have any trouble finding another job, Sugar Booger.
No, see, I tried. I applied for every single opening in my field, but there's nothing right now.
Lelaina Pierce is the main character, and she is having trouble making the transition from being very successful in college to sort of starting at the bottom in the real world.
Why don't you get a job at Burgerama? They'll hire you.
Because I was valedictorian of my university.
Well, you don't have to put that down on your application.
I always had Winona Ryder in mind because there was just something that was quirky and offbeat enough about her that she had a vulnerability and just an authenticity about her that I just identified with.
I was really gonna be something by the age of 23.
Honey, all you have to be by the age of 23 is yourself.
Anymore.
Then we have her best friend, Vicky. Vicky is sort of just kind of marches to the beat of her own drummer, makes her own rules.
The free clinic AIDS test, the rite of passage for our generation. We're so lucky. Come on.
Janine brought a whole kind of attitude to that character that was really not on the page. I mean, the lines were the same, but her delivery and her sense of timing, and she just has such a strong voice that she and the character sort of enmeshed.
He's weird, he's strange, he's sloppy, he's a total nightmare for women. I can't believe I haven't slept with him yet.
She kind of embodied the sexual mores of the time because we had a storyline about AIDS.
And it's like, it's not even happening to me. It's like I'm watching it on some crappy show like Melrose Place or something, right? And I'm the new character. I'm the HIV AIDS character. And I live in the building and I teach everybody that it's okay to be near me. It's okay to talk to me. And then I die. And there's everybody at my funeral wearing halter tops and chokers or something like that.
And then we have Sammy.
You know, I think the real reason that I've been celibate for so long isn't really because I'm that terrified of the big A, but because I can't really start my life without being honest about who I am.
I've met people, especially men, who say that was their first time they'd seen a depiction of a gay guy in a film who wasn't, like, you know, stereotypical, who was integrated into their friend group and it was not a thing either way.
I want to be in there too. I want to feel miserable and happy and all of that. I mean, I want to be let back in the house.
I am not under any orders to make the world a better place.
Well, then what good are you?
Troy, that's Ethan Hawke's character. He represented a pure kind of artist. And he sort of has an armor of irony. And that's kind of how he protects himself from, I guess you'd say, the corporate world or the idea of selling out.
Did he dazzle you with his extensive knowledge of mineral water? I just would have liked to have been there to watch how you rationalized sleeping with a yuppie head cheese ball on the first date.
He's not a yuppie.
He's the reason why Cliff Notes were invented.
Ethan's super into poetry and writing and reading and music and experiencing life. You know, he comes off as a guy who is like that, and he actually is that guy.
Well, should I get married? Should I be good? Should I astound the girl next door with my velvet suit and my Faustus hood? Not take her to movies, but to cemeteries and tell her of werewolf tongues and forked clarinets.
I'm Lisa Loeb. I am a singer-songwriter. Right before Reality Bites, I had graduated from Brown University a couple years earlier, and I was living downtown in New York City, and I had a really great creative group of friends, who included Ethan Hawke.
What Hey That's My Bike would like to do, eventually, as a band, is travel the countryside like Woody Guthrie.
Or Richard Simmons. You know, in his commercials, I travels around, surprises people jogging.
At the time that they were making Reality Bites, Ethan had asked me to write a song for his band in the movie, because he's in a band, in a rock band in the movie, and he needed to sing a song called I'm Nothing. My song, I'm Nothing, did not get into the movie, but Ethan was still such a big fan and a supporter, he asked me for a copy of my song Stay on a cassette tape, and Ethan passed it along to all of the people who were involved in the production and the direction of the movie.
You say, I only hear what I want to.
I was temp working, and I got this call from the record company RCA Records, Ron Fair, and he said he wanted to include my song Stay on the Reality Bite soundtrack, and I was so excited. I told all the people who I was working with that I was not coming back as a temp worker, and they told me I could take as many office supplies as I wanted.
I know why the cage bird sings and everything.
Oh, yeah, why?
Because he was in a cage and he was, I don't know, he had high hopes or something. Okay, I dropped out of school before we got to that, right?
Of course, Ben Stiller's character, Michael. Ben certainly was a co-creator of the character of Michael. I think Michael was, I really liked that character because he was always trying so hard.
You know what you are, man? You know what you remind me of? You're like that guy with the, you know, with the hat and the bells and the little, you know,
the court jester.
Yeah, right, where everything's so easy to laugh at from a safe distance back in clever land. You know what happens to him? They find his skull in a grave and they go, oh, I knew him and he was funny.
Ben is so likable that became the whole thing of people to say, oh, Lilina picked the wrong guy.
And I wish I could be perfect, okay? I mean, I wish I could be like Troy riding on his melted cheese sandwich and everything, but...
Don't you dare bring Troy into this!
Hey, I wish I could be like him. I mean, I wish I could live off of creeds and mottos and all that shit, all right? But I'm in the real world here, okay? And I have ideals also.
But also, I think Michael was very prescient and is a sign of things to come, where you're commodifying life and repackaging it and selling people back to themselves in a way.
Michael Great, Vice President Regional Programming, in your face TV. We've seen it's like MTV, but with an edge.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Good, and welcome to Wedgie. This bandana by Donna Karen is blue for Crips, red for Bloods, and only costs $75.
Ooh, literally.
Back in the olden days of selling out, when selling out was selling out, now selling out is just having a job.
There's no such thing as selling out anymore. There's nothing wrong with packaging yourself or your life as a brand and putting it out there. But at the time, it seemed really important.
You shut up! I busted my ass to find a job, any job. You don't even bother showing up for interviews.
What is it that you want from me, huh? What is it? You want me to get a job on the line for the next 20 years? Until I'm granted leave with my gold-plated watch and my balls full of tumors because I surrendered the one thing that means shit to me? Well, honey, you can just exhale because it's not going to happen, not in this lifetime.
Even though we were all supposed to be part of this Generation X in retrospect, in general, all the people that were part of my life, we didn't have this kind of big question mark in the sky about, like, who are we and what are we going to do?
There was a cover of Newsweek or Time about the baby buster generation. And the main thrust of it seemed to be, hey, we can't figure out how to market to these kids. These kids are, you know, they're savvy to all your tricks and, you know, they'll kind of make fun of it back to you. The fact that they are making fun of the brands as they use them is sort of, again, it's the use of irony as a self-protective kind of mechanism.
Troy, aren't you excited?
I'm bursting with fruit flavor.
Evian is naive spelled backwards.
When I see it now, it's hard. It's like reading your diary or something. I mean, it's obviously these are thoughts and, you know, conversations that I was having when I was 20 to 23. But it's funny, you know, what ends up striking a note with people. I think it was the fact that we were the people we were making the movie about. There was not that much separation between what the script was and what we were all going through at that time. There's no way to formulate, okay, we're going to make a generational movie about these crazy kids today. I think you can just make an honest movie. Like a lot of people say, is it a good movie? Is it a bad movie? In a way, I don't like that. I just think, is it an authentic movie? You know, was it honestly trying to say something? And I know that we really were. I mean, it was important to us. I guess like she says in the movie.
I know it wasn't going to, you know, end world hunger, you know, save the planet, but it just meant something to me.
Can you turn this up, please? You won't be sorry. Thank you.
That story was produced by Jenny Cataldo and BMP Audio. Reality Bites came out a quarter century ago. Feel old? Well, when Ethan Hawke was here a few months ago, he mentioned that he recently played a grandfather. And by the way, Ben Stiller's most recent directorial work was the miniseries Escape at Dannemora, which I highly recommend. And that's it for this week's episode. Studio 360 is a production of PRI, Public Radio International, in association with Slate. Our executive producer is
Jocelyn Gonzalez.
Our senior editor is
Andrew Adam Newman.
Our sound engineer is
Sandra Lopez Monsalve.
Our producers are
Evan Chung,
Lauren Hansen,
Sam Kim,
Zoe Saunders,
Tommy Bazarian.
Our production assistant is
Morgan Flannery.
And I am Kurt Anderson.
He's weird, he's strange, he's sloppy, he's a total nightmare for women. I can't believe I haven't slept with him yet.
Thank you very much for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time on Studio 360, why Richard E. Grant ends up playing so many wastrels and ne'er-do-wells.
Usually the casting director or a director chooses you according to how they think you fit into their vision of something. So you're kind of, you know, taught for hire, really.
Richard E. Grant's long overdue Oscar nomination, part of a special hour about the Academy Awards. Next time on Studio 360.